This is Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your radio tuned to the left and your mind in the open position as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
I'm talking with Dr. Nicholas Christakis. He's associate professor of sociology and medicine at the University of Chicago. He's an internist and a hospice physician. And can you just tell us briefly, what is a hospice physician?
A hospice physician is somebody who takes care of patients at the end of their life and is concerned more with the quality of their lives and the relief of their symptoms than with attempting to cure an underlying condition, which fundamentally is no longer curable at that stage. And so hospice is a form of care that emphasizes relief of pain and suffering. It's a form of care that patients receive in their own homes in our country and is provided by an interdisciplinary team of individuals, the physician being one of them. Mm-hmm. And so I care for terminally ill patients when I see patients.
You got interested in the field of terminal illness because of a personal situation with your mother. She was ill for 19 years?
Yes, and as I mentioned in the book, one of sort of certainly a formative experience in my life was having doctors make a prediction when I was a little boy, I was six, that my mother was going to die within 3 weeks, and she didn't. She lived actually for 19 years, but I tell the story, or at least allude to it at the dedication in the book, not so much to poke fun at the physician, but rather to, especially since I've become a physician now myself, to communicate how empathetic I am to the difficulties in making predictions and how grateful I was both that the physician made a prediction and that it proved to be wrong. But it certainly was a formative experience in my life, kind of feeling like we were living under this sword of Damocles and, as I say, both the craving and detesting prognostic precision.
Now, the book we're talking about is your new book, Death Foretold, Prophecy and Prognosis in Medical Care, which is forthcoming from University of Chicago Press. And the concerns in the book are much broader than even medicine, but and certainly broader than foretelling death necessarily. But what you identify in this book is that physicians very rarely make prognoses. We think of the classic paradigmatic situation with a physician being, how long have I got, doc, or tell me what you would do in this situation, given what you know, that kind of thing. But you point out that physicians are loath to often talk about prognosis with patients.
I mean, that's certainly the case. And in fact, you know, the sort of the how long do I have to live doctor, which has sort of almost become a cliche. One of the studies that we did actually tried to quantify how frequently do physicians face that question. And the sort of average oncologist is asked that question 100 times a year and has to face patients' quite reasonable requests for this type of information. And most of the time, oncologists and other physicians, not just cancer doctors, but doctors taking care of patients of all kinds of problems, struggle mightily in order to answer these questions. And the book shows that generally the doctors avoid this question. They don't answer the question. And when they do, they do so in certain highly stylized, very sort of ritualized and kind of they do so in certain systematic ways, which the book tries to unpack. And in fact, one of the main distinctions that the book makes is a distinction between the notion of foreseeing the future and foretelling the future. And I argue that doctors are defective or struggle with not merely the challenge of foretelling the future, or that is to say, communicating the prognosis to the patient, but also struggle with and I believe do a poor job of foreseeing the future and even formulating prognosis. So there are two distinct tasks. There's formulation and communication of the prognosis,
right.
And doctors have problems with both.
Well, let's start with the first then. We think of medical science as having an enormous body of knowledge, but why is it difficult for doctors to be able to answer that question in the first place, especially when they see conditions, hundreds of people dying of cancer, all the, you know, every year, why would it be difficult for an oncologist to tell a patient how long they have to live?
Well, as I said, there's two distinct issues. They have difficulty telling the patient, both because they have difficulty formulating the prognosis.
Right.
Well, and why don't they communicate?
Well, let's start with the why don't they know.
Okay, why don't they know? Well, I mean, you would think that that they would know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we think of medicine as involving the cognitive tasks of medicine as involving three primary functions, diagnosis, therapy, and prognosis. And certainly diagnosis and therapy have gotten a huge amount of attention, and there's a huge amount of knowledge about them. And as it turns out, there's not as much knowledge about prognosis. Now, a large fraction of the book is directed at trying to understand, now, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the paradoxes, or one of the sort of quirky observations about this, is that approximately 100 years ago, prognosis was actually a very central and prominent part of medical care. And if you look at textbooks, for instance, from 100 years ago, as much attention, if not more attention, is spent teaching physicians about how to prognosticate than about how to diagnose or treat disease. In fact, not only does the amount of attention in terms of sort of fractions of chapters that are devoted to the topic of prognosis being the same as diagnosis and therapy, not only is the amount of attention the same, but often the prognosis for a condition precedes the diagnosis or treatment of a condition in the order in which the topics are treated in the textbooks.
Everyone I've seen with your symptoms dies in 10 days.
For instance, right.
Now let's figure out what you got.
Right, and that's what you got, or how we're going to treat it because. And of course, the reason I believe that this was the case is that at that particular historical moment, the doctors knew that their treatments were not very effective. And so their professional role was to predict the issue of disease. The patient went to the doctor not so much to have their condition eliminated, because sort of everyone knew that it couldn't be eliminated, but rather to have the doctor tell them what was going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I believe that one of the reasons prognosis has vanished from, relatively speaking, from modern textbooks and from modern practice largely, is in fact the ascendancy of therapy.
Mm-hmm. So we have so many ways to dick around with patients that we can't predict anything.
right. Exactly. We have so many things we can do to patients or for them the doctors, you see, can feel effective in their social roles, can feel like they're doing something, and oftentimes they are doing something for patients, but it becomes very easy to ignore the prognostic part of practice. Part of the reasons that doctors don't communicate prognoses to patients is because they don't have prognostic information available to them. Because, for example, the information is not in the textbooks. It's not in the research journals. There's not a lot of research being done on how to prognosticate. Now, some of these things are changing, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but unimpeachably the case that the attention given to, the research devoted to, the textbook space devoted to prognosis is far, far less than that devoted to diagnosis.
Well, we have a lot of statistical data available to modern medicine now. We have all of the patient records of all the people who have died for the last 50 years. So that we're becoming increasingly sophisticated, and we have computer programs that take into account various. Well, tell us about Apache, for instance. Isn't this one of the?
Well, there are a number of. There are a number of sophisticated sort of actuarial statistical methods for predicting the outcome of various patients' conditions. And I feel kind of ambivalently about them, to be honest with you. On the one hand, I definitely believe that doctors should familiarize themselves with these tools, should certainly use them as sort of adjuvants to their decision-making. You know, they should take advantage of these statistical tools, be familiar with the way they work, and use them to enhance the accuracy of their own predictions, and full stop. The research has shown that actually doctors that their predictions can in fact be enhanced. The quality of their predictions, that is to say, the accuracy of their predictions, can be enhanced by using these things.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have two further comments on the role of using statistical methods for making predictions. The first is that I don't think that doctors should kind of abrogate their responsibility by kind of relying on this sort of mechanistic solution to the problem. Right, we're just going to use these statistical equations and we don't have to be doctors anymore. We'll just rely on this little black box and it'll make a prediction. First point.
Mm-hmm.
Second point is a subtler point, and it's the following one. If you have a wonderfully perfectly calibrated, it is called, or highly accurate prognostic statistical system. If the system tells you with great precision that the patient has a 1% chance of survival or a 99% chance of survival, that could be of great utility to you in your practice. The problem, however, is that most patients have a 50% chance of survival, let's say. So even though the statistical algorithm works extremely well and tells you with great accuracy that this patient has a 50% chance of survival, actually, it may not be that useful to you in that situation. Mm-hmm. Because what are you to do with that particular information? Mm-hmm. And so that's when the other concerns that the book engages might be much more relevant. You know, how do you communicate that information, for instance, to the patient?
Right.
Or what do you do if you thought the patient had a 90% chance of survival, but the actuarial mechanism is telling you they have a 50% chance, for instance?
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you address in the book is the various rituals that doctors have mm-hmm. around communicating, because in the absence of... Well, tell us also why you think physicians have avoided, even when they have knowledge about prognosis, why have they avoided telling patients, and then what rituals have developed around that?
Well, one of the key chapters in the book is called The Self-Fulfilling Prophecy in Medicine. Mm-hmm. And it actually builds on some work done by Robert Merton years ago. And shows, I hope convincingly, that even sort of American physicians practicing in the late 1990s believe in the self-fulfilling prophecy. Doctors actually think that the predictions they make can cause corresponding outcomes. And if you imagine a world in which that is the case, it becomes very rapidly very clear why doctors would do two things. First of all, when the news is bad, they would avoid communicating it. Why? Because they would fear that communicating this bad news would maybe bring about an unfavorable outcome. And second, they would also, to the extent that they believe that articulating a certain prediction can actually cause a corresponding outcome, would quite naturally shade the truth towards the positive end. And the book then develops a subsidiary argument about the notion of the ritualization of optimism, which is, to the extent that doctors believe in the self-fulfilling prophecy, they actually have highly ritualized ways of being optimistic. Now, most people might hear that and think, so what? And in fact, it is, I think, the case. I mean, who wants to go to a doctor that's a pessimist or a nihilist?
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, it's like Eeyore, you know, my kids in, you know, Winnie the Pooh books, you know, they're like, you know, it'll never work. It's too risky. You know,
right.
There's nothing we can do for you and so forth. We choose our doctors to be optimistic. We kind of train them in the way that cultivates that optimism. We want them to have a kind of aggressive, kind of can-do, we shall overcome, activistic, melioristic kind of attitude towards what they do.
Right.
And that's great.
Unless you're a managed care administrator.
Correct. In that, which case, you want them to go to the other extreme and sort of not do anything. But the point is, there comes a time in the care of a patient when that kind of philosophical and practical stance actually harms the patient. Why? Because it leads to the overuse of certain futile treatments. It results in the doctor not seeing that the patient is manifestly dying and failing to avail themselves of good palliative care at what is at a really critical and vulnerable moment in the patient's illness. And so you get these horror situations of families not knowing that the patient is about to die, failing to tell the beloved child to come from the West Coast to come and be with a dying person,
mm-hmm.
failing to anticipate the imminence of death and thinking that the patient is better than they are and not focusing on really attending to a lot of important issues near the end of life.
Mm-hmm.
And who, I would ask, is justly responsible for this? Or,
mm-hmm.
And I would argue that the physician is the person with the means and the responsibility to change this,
mm-hmm.
to have to sort of pull back and abandon the patient, certainly not, but rather to kind of redirect themselves at the right moment and not become pessimistic, but not become so blinded by the optimism that they lose the ability to provide high quality care to their patients.
Given that there is this bias towards optimism, which tends to be a bias against palliative care,
they're linked, yeah, for sure.
Is your book in a way an argument for palliative care? I mean, you are a palliative care doc, and so you see the underutilization of your services. I mean, I'm not saying that it's self-serving.
Implicitly. I mean, implicitly, implicitly, I suppose it is. But let me back up a moment and give you just a sort of, I think, one of our recent projects looked at doctors' abilities to predict the future, and we asked doctors to predict how long patients would live. This was a large sample of patients that were terminally ill, and then we observed how long the patients actually did live, and we compared one to the other, and we found that doctors overestimated patient survival by more than a factor of five. So doctors are systematically overestimating survival in these patients. And as a consequence of that, they make certain other secondary decisions, which, as I said earlier, may harm their patients. And specifically, as you're pointing out, they may make choices that are against or don't emphasize the palliative aspects of end-of-life care. And yes, I think that to the extent that we could make them better predictors, I think it would quite naturally lead to better attention to the quality of life at the end of life.
Which is a very timely message. By the way, I'm talking with Dr. Nicholas Christakis. He's Associate Professor of Sociology and Medicine and author of the forthcoming Death Foretold, Prophecy and Prognosis in Medical Care, and you're listening to Change Surfer Radio, Dr. J. One of the questions I was going to ask you was about futurology.
A favorite topic of yours.
Yeah, a favorite topic of this show, actually. You're looking at this in a much broader context about the impacts of prediction on all of society and trying to talk about this in the context of how prophets function in societies, right? And on the one hand, physicians, you're arguing that physicians are not living up to their prophetic mission in a way, right? Because they're not talking about prophecy enough. But there are a lot of prophets in our society, and prophecy is a political currency. So can you talk a little bit about...
Well, I mean, yes, I think the book is quite clearly about prognosis in medicine, but I think that the role of prognosis in medicine or prognostication in medicine is illustrative of a broader social phenomenon, which is sort of prediction in social life more generally. And one of the broader questions I seek to address is, what is the role of knowledge of the future and of claims to such knowledge in social life in general and not merely in medicine? And I think that the sort of the relationship between a prophet or someone who claims to have and is believed to have information about the future, whether it's in a medical domain or in a business domain or in an educational domain or even in a meteorological domain, such an individual who is believed to have such information and claims to have such information is like a prophet. And then a person who requests such information is in a sense in a sort of subordinate role and is like a supplicant. And this kind of prophet-supplicant relationship, I think, plays out very broadly in social life. And I think that if you think about it, there's a lot of attention to predictions in all kinds of other domains. For instance, in the political domains, you know, politicians will articulate particular visions of the future and in so doing kind of motivate individuals to act in certain ways. Or charismatic leaders of sort of prophetic movements will typically cause quite extraordinary behaviors in their believers as a result of the vision that they've articulated. Or stock market gurus who make certain predictions will cause people to deploy capital in unbelievable ways in response to predictions.
But isn't it true that prophets are only benefit from their prophecy if they're never held accountable for the accuracy of the prophecy?
Well, one of the things is, and this is an ancient concern, how do you distinguish a true prophet from a false prophet?
Right.
Especially when the prophet is making predictions that are not empirically verifiable. And there's actually a fascinating literature on how the ancients and sort of a theological literature and an ancient philosophical literature on how this problem was tackled. And very briefly, the concerns focus on the kind of moral integrity of the prophet is used as a proxy for the accuracy of their predictions. So a right, you know, an upstanding, a man or a woman, a man typically of upstanding moral character is more likely to be a true prophet than a false prophet.
Right. As opposed to some blind woman in, in Greece, some Cassandra.
Right, exactly. Cassandra was disbelieved, and some argue that it was because partly of her gender.
Right.
But there are other issues in Cassandra's case.
Right.
You know, Tiresias was, you know, much beloved, or well revered at least. But, So how does one distinguish a true prophet from a false prophet? One way is attributes of the prophet. Another is sort of attributes of the prophecy, the content. That is to say, prophets who make predictions that are consistent with the tradition or follow in certain kind of certain rhetorical demands are considered to be more likely to be accurate than others, mm-hmm. and so forth. And there are a number of well-developed ways. And in fact, if you think about it, if you went to your doctor, you expect prophets to confine themselves to predictions in their level of in their domain of expertise.
Right.
If you went to your doctor and asked your doctor for a prediction about the direction of your portfolio, mm-hmm. that would be regarded as quite peculiar on all sides.
Right.
The doctor would not be considered the appropriate prophet for that, nor if the doctor volunteered such comments, you would regard that as ridiculous.
Right.
Because the doctor has a different expertise. It's supposed to be about the future of medicine, of your clinical situation. So there are a variety of ways. And then, of course, the doctor has undergone a lengthy initiation, wears the certain trappings, has certain instruments and costumes and so forth.
But the point about accountability is part of the reason that doctors don't make prognoses because they are in the peculiar position of actually being possible to hold them accountable for their prognoses. I mean, if a patient comes back later and says, you told me 6 months ago...
Yes.
That I had, they only had 3 months, and now I'm still alive. Or you said I had 10 years, and I'm about to die. Then you're much more accountable than if you said, if I
the
say
earth is gonna end
socialism will come in 100 years, and who's right. ever going to hold me accountable for it?
Right, certainly not me, Jay.
Yeah.
No, I think you're absolutely right to draw attention to that. And in fact, is one of the other chapters in the book is called Error and Accountability, and it is about this precise problem that the doctors. Feel that the patients will hold them responsible for their predictions in a variety of ways. First of all, they feel the patients will expect them to deliver on the prediction. And that is a very demanding accountability if you think about it. And they also fear that the patients will hold them accountable for errors in prediction if they don't deliver. So they kind of feel damned if they do, damned if they don't. To make a prediction is to sort of put yourself in the kind of an omnipotent situation where you're screwed no matter what happens. If the outcome is favorable, you're kind of if you make a favorable prediction, the patient expects you to kind of make that happen. And if you make an error in prediction, the patient holds you responsible for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I think that certainly in that aspect, the accountability, the role of the physician may be a little different than the kind of idealized notion of a prophet that we have. But think about politicians who make predictions as well. Vote for me if you do, this or that thing will happen. And they may either explicitly or implicitly have no intention of...
Well, maybe precisely part of the reason why we don't trust politicians anymore.
Well, yes, I think that may be part of it. But I also think that we also... expect. I mean, part of the political role, politicians will vie with each other for who is going to articulate not necessarily the most accurate, but perhaps merely the most desirable future. And patients will do the same kind of thing. They'll go to different doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Shop around for different prognoses. And doctors are aware of this too, of course. And they're aware of the fact that, patients may be evaluating them. It's almost like a trivial example, but it's like people who pick realtors based on the realtor that says, I can sell your house for the most money.
Right.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Show me the money.
Right.
Okay, I want to... this is fascinating, and I really recommend this very exciting book, Death Foretold, Prophecy and Prognosis in Medical Care. But I want to touch on two more of your exciting projects. You're doing The Health Benefits of Marriage. Now, this has been a long-debated set of issues. Is there a health benefit of marriage?
Yes, I should say that my wife finds it incredibly ironic that I am investigating this topic, but I have become quite fond of this topic. Yes, there's a health benefit of marriage. Our best current research suggests that our best estimates of the pure benefit of marriage, that is to say, how many years of life marriage adds to a man's life, is 8 years. Hmm. Now, it is not the case that it's a zero-sum game and the wife loses 8 years. She also benefits, but not to the same extent.
And that's because women nag us to stop smoking and eat better?
Demographers have used a number of cute kind of expressions. One of them is called, in fact, the nagging function of marriage. But yes, in the case of men, the argument goes that there are a variety of mechanisms by which marriage may be beneficial. One of them is to sort of encourage healthier behaviors. But there are other more subtle and complex ways in which the benefit is felt to occur as well.
Less stress,
more feelings of responsibility,
more likely to have kids.
So. Yes, and those kinds of things. So And it also contributes to capital.
Kids actually adds life to man.
I can empathize. But the point is that, you know, there are a variety of ways you accumulate money, you know, wealth increases, and all of these various mechanisms.
Now, your other project is a book that you're writing on iatrogenesis, the fact that medicine sometimes makes us sick.
Correct.
And you're pulling together a lot of research all over the field on this.
Yeah, that is going to be a book on... I've become very interested in sort of unintended consequences of things that people do. And iatrogenesis is a wonderful way to study that, because doctors, generally speaking, don't intend for bad things to happen to their patients as a result of the treatments they are given.
Mm-hmm. But this was very common under fee-for-service medicine, that doctors were doing so much to us that they made us sick. They were giving us too many surgeries, too many drugs. And it was kind of collusion between patients who wanted a lot more and doctors who wanted to give us a lot more because they made a profit off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And now under managed care, we're going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to... I'm going to resist the temptation to be drawn into a debate or a discussion about managed care for a variety of reasons, among which is that I don't know very much about managed care from a sort of research standpoint. But I think it is the case that a lot... I mean, there are some recent estimates done by other investigators that tens of thousands of Americans, I don't remember the precise number, but it's 50, 60, maybe more per year, die from iatrogenic errors.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those are, for instance, as a result of treatments they got that they didn't need, mm-hmm. maybe for some of the reasons that you're alluding to. Others are treatments that they needed, but they had unintended side effects or complications that contributed to their death. Mm-hmm. And countless more, I mean, probably in the hundreds of thousands, have non-mortal problems that accrue to mm-hmm. them as a result of their treatment. When I was in training, one of my superiors told me a phrase which I pass down to people that I train, which is hospital admission is not a benign procedure. merely admitting someone to the hospital puts them at serious risk of death.
Right.
And actually, I touch on the iatrogenesis a little bit in the book that we were just speaking about, the Death Foretold book, because if you think about what we were talking about earlier, the notion of self-fulfilling prophecy, if doctors really believe in sort of voodoo death, which was a classic paper by a physician from the 1940s, that telling someone they're going to die could cause the death, that is iatrogenesis.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with Dr. Nicholas Christakis. He's associate professor of sociology and medicine, an internist, and a hospice doctor, the author of forthcoming Death Foretold from the University of Chicago Press. I want to really thank you for joining us, Dr. Christakis.
Thank you very much, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.